It's Central Time. I'm Veronica Ricker.
And I'm Rob Ferret. Coming up, a new documentary sheds light on the struggles of Jackie Nitschke, the wife of a Green Bay Packers legend. As she battled alcohol addiction, we'll hear from the filmmaker and the director of the rehab center opened in her honor.
First, President Obama's recent executive action on immigration shielded about 4 million unauthorized immigrants from deportation and gave them the opportunity to apply for a 3-year working permit.
Some Wisconsin farmers were looking for more changes. The president's action applied largely to parents of U.S. citizens and to immigrants who came here before the age of 16. Farm advocates, especially in the dairy industry, some want visa programs that allow immigrants who work in agriculture to stay year-round. Currently, agriculture visas are geared toward migrant workers who do temporary work.
According to a UW-Madison study, about 40% of workers in the dairy industry in Wisconsin are immigrants, and they estimate that half of them do not have the proper documentation. The National Milk Farm Producers Federation has said that immigration reform is a top legislative priority. Darren Von Ruden joins us now, president of the Wisconsin Farmers Union. He also owns a 50-cow organic dairy farm. Darren, welcome to Central Time.
Thank you.
What action on immigration were you looking for from President Obama to help, as you see it, the ag industry?
Well, you know, just to start off, too, Wisconsin Farmers Union doesn't really have policy on immigration, but we do have quite a few members that do have immigrants on their employed on their farm. But the biggest thing that our members are looking for is, you know, extended visas or else a longer time that they can stay in the country legally. Because as dairy farmers, we need help 365 days out of the year.
So without those extended visas right now, as you're looking for, what is the situation like on farms, especially dairy farms in Wisconsin?
But, you know, if they have just a six-month visa, after 6 months, the dairy farmer has to find a new employee or else, hopefully in most cases, the employee actually helps find their replacement. It'd be nice if we could look at keeping those employees on the farms for a longer period of time.
So you're describing a pretty quick rate of turnover there, possibly every 6 months for some workers. How does that affect the farms and how they run?
Well, your animals, dairy cows especially, like a lot of routine, so the same thing day after day. And if you bring in new people, there's always an adjustment period for the animals there. Plus, there's that adjustment period between the owner of the farm and the employees, too, because not everybody has the same work ethics and the ability to work with animals like the person before them necessarily do.
Is there a slowdown in production as the learning curve begins and new workers get accustomed to the process?
Yep. You know, unless they've done some of that work in their home countries, it takes anywhere from a week to 3 weeks for employees to adjust to what the farmer does. And dairy farms across the state, everybody does things a little bit differently. Nobody seems to have the same routine. So there's always going to be an adjustment period for a new employee to come on when they do come onto the farm.
Now, if a farm wanted to employ people who had papers or were legal workers here in Wisconsin that would allow them to work year-round, year after year, what would the competition be like for those workers?
Well, you know, right now it's strong at this point in time with the dairy industry changing in the state and across the nation. There's going to be more and more of a demand for immigrant help on those farms. And so I think if there was a longer time that they could be there, there might actually be a stronger demand from the owners of the farms to keep the best employees there.
Does not having new action on farm workers in terms of immigration visas protect jobs for legal Wisconsin residents?
Well, you know, it's one of those things that there's a lot of farm jobs that the average Wisconsinite or the average U.S. citizen don't want to undertake. Some of it has to do a little bit with the pay, as farmers are struggling to keep the farms operating due to what they're being paid for their product. They can only offer so much on a per-hour basis, and so that's always a struggle to get somebody to come out to the farm and help out. If you can't pay them well enough, they can go work in McDonald's or Walmart and make just as much money without the job descriptions that dairy farms have.
Now, for those workers who go through this six-month cycle, their visa lasts for 6 months and then they have to leave, do they typically find their way back to that farm maybe in a year or so, or how does that work?
Some of them do it due to that. There's some cases that where the immigrants actually have been allowed to stay for 2 6-month periods, which so they have that ability to stay for a year. But that's not common practice within the dairy industry.
In terms of the jobs that you were talking about, some of the jobs you say that some workers might not want to do or find palatable, what kind of jobs are we talking about?
Well, milking cows is the big one. So if you're working on a dairy farm, you're milking cows for 6 to 8 hours at a time. So you're, you know, working in a little bit more of a dirty environment with cows that they have manure and everything else that they do during milking, cleaning pens, feeding calves, all jobs that require a lot of handling of the animals. And there's as the animals get bigger, there's more and more dangerous situations for the employees at that point.
And how much do those jobs typically pay?
The latest survey that I've seen come out of the Department of Ag here in Wisconsin showed that the average dairy farmer for milking was receiving about $11 an hour.
Why would you say Wisconsin farmers, especially the dairy industry, as we've said, why has it come to be reliant on immigrant workers?
I think most of it has been the national food policy, wanting food as cheap as possible. And so with that situation, a lot of family farms, smaller farms, have been forced out of business over the years just because they can't pay their bills at the end of the month because they're not getting paid what they have stuck in 100 weight of milk. And or, you know, even the beef industry and the crop industries over the years have been really struggling to keep farm owners on their land. And then when the smaller ones leave, the bigger ones end up picking up the slack. And so we're at a point now where we're seeing more and more larger farms here in the state and nationally than we are small farmer operations starting up.
Why do you think that this was one area of the executive actions on immigration that didn't get addressed?
Yeah, probably because it's the smallest sector of the immigration numbers. Actually, hotel and restaurant businesses tend to be a larger employee of immigrant labor.
And do you see it as part of your organization's mission to make the case that this is something that's important and needs to be looked at? Or do you think this is a smaller piece of the puzzle that maybe should be addressed later?
Well, yeah, I think it's a smaller piece of the puzzle. There's other issues within agriculture that I think should be addressed before we start looking at immigration.
How optimistic are you about seeing reform like this somewhere in the future?
Well, until we can get Congress and the Senate to start working with the White House, and it doesn't matter which party's in charge there, when they start working together, then things can happen. So, you know, I don't think anything's going to happen in this election cycle. It would surprise me, but if we can get Washington to work like the rest of the countryside is working together to get the job done, then we could possibly see some true immigration reform.
Darren, thank you for joining us.
Thank you.
We've been speaking with Darren Von Ruden, president of the Wisconsin Farmers Union, about the kind of immigration reform that some Wisconsin farmers are looking for. Former middle linebacker Ray Nitschke is still a legend in the Packers franchise. At the height of his career, he and his family lived a public life as superstars in northeast Wisconsin.
Privately, each of them struggled with alcohol. At a time when Packers wives were expected to uphold a certain image, Ray's wife Jackie was the first Packer wife to publicly acknowledge her addiction.
Now a new documentary brings Jackie's story to life and aims to raise awareness about these issues. The film will be screened tonight at the Widener Center for the Performing Arts in Green Bay at 6:30. Here's a clip.
Jackie was a force of nature. She was larger than life. You knew when she was happy, she laughed. And she didn't just giggle or snicker. She would laugh.
Jim Rivett is the producer and director of Champion, The Legacy of Jackie Nitschke. Jim, thanks for joining us.
Oh, thank you. Nice to be here.
And Bill Labine is also with us. He's the executive director of the Jackie Nitschke Center in Green Bay. Bill, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
So, Jim, let's start with you. Why was it important for you to get Jackie's story out there by producing this documentary?
Well, I got involved in the Jackie Nitschke Center by having a young gentleman kind of come into our building, and he was in need of addiction recovery, and we got him connected to the Jackie Nitschke Center and just saw this need and kind of got involved on the board, and then we just felt that this was a great way to tell the story of what the Jackie Nitschke Center provides to the community. They're just a great resource for addiction recovery.
We'll get into the center in just a moment, but Jim, for Jackie, how did her struggle with alcohol begin?
Well, you know, she really helped Ray clean up his act. I mean, he was threatened with losing his job if Lombardi was really getting down on him because he was getting really wild and drinking a lot and getting in fights. She got him, you know, sober. But then I think she became addicted because she was leading this stressful life of the celebrity wife. You know, they're kind of invisible. Beverly Lofton talks a lot about how you become almost invisible. Everybody wants to get to your husband. They're a star status. And I think a lot of these women turn to alcohol as a way to numb themselves from the pain and the loneliness.
And how big a deal was it when this model Packer wife came out and said, hey, I'm trying to deal with this alcohol addiction?
I think she was so ahead of her time to be able to do something that took such courage at that time in Green Bay's history and football history. That really took a lot of guts to do that, because first of all, your husband is a celebrity in the NFL, and then you're coming out with this very honest, candid need to express what's going on in your life, but you're also working tirelessly to help others in the recovery community get sober. I think that's what was really so different about Jackie.
Now, Bill Labine, you're the head of a substance abuse recovery center bearing Jackie's name. Would you say a lot of people can relate one way or another to Jackie's struggle with alcoholism?
I think what Jackie really did was she spoke publicly about the disease. In our society, especially in Wisconsin, we have such a drinking culture. The people, families, they're too ashamed to talk about it. They think they're responsible, or it was poor parenting, or there's some excuse about why they're addicted to some type of chemical or alcohol. But Jackie started the conversation that it's an illness and it's okay to talk about it. And we're trying to carry on her efforts through the documentary and what we do here at the Jackie Nitschke Center to give people permission to talk about this illness. We're all affected by it. It's confusing to everybody. We understand it pretty good, and we know how to help people get well. But it just starts by raising community awareness and letting people know it's okay to talk about it, and there's help available.
And Bill, why is it important to have a documentary like this one that's aimed at people in your part of the state?
Well, I watched it again Thanksgiving morning at 4 o'clock, and what I really noticed was how much love there was between Ray and Jackie and their family unit, and just how that overcame the illness, and they're a great asset to the community. It was much more powerful than Ray being a great football player in the Green Bay Packers, but it was really about the family coming together, tackling some tough issues, having the courage to do so, and then carrying that message to the public.
And Jim, in pulling together this documentary, let's follow up on Bill's point there. What kind of impact did Jackie's alcohol addiction have on her family and the kids?
I think her daughter Amy is somebody who really has a lot of admiration for her mother. She saw her go through some difficult times, but Amy is in the documentary as well, and just the love that she has for both of her parents and the legacy that they left behind, I think, is so honorable. But even Bart and Cherry Starr talk about their son's death from an overdose, and it's just really. And Chester Markle, the same thing. Their stories are just really heartfelt, and it's so neat that they could come out and be so candid with their own aspect of addiction that touched their lives.
Bill, there's a bit in the documentary where they talk to some of the people who have been through treatment in your center. One of the people talks about hearing his dad say, I hate you, and the kid saying, I think at this point, I hate me too. How wrenching do these stories get before people go out and seek help like this?
Actually, that was William Moyers, and his father, Bill Moyers, pulled him out of a crack house, and then that's when the conversation took place. The stories, they're all heart-wrenching, gut-wrenching. it's a devastating illness, and we're encouraging people to start talking about it. There's a lot of pain with the disease of addiction. It's fatal. It does a lot of damage, and it affects the entire family and the community.
I want to connect Jackie Nitschke's story to the Jackie Nitschke Center. Bill, how did the center come into existence?
In 1972 to 1995, this place was a halfway house for men and women following their primary treatment, and it was funded by the county. And then in 1995, that funding discontinued, and it began a 28-day treatment program. The Samaritan House really struggled. And then because of the great work that Jackie did in our community, and right about a year previous, she passed away. We then approached Ray Nitschke and asked Ray if we could rename the facility after Jackie for all the great work she did in the community helping other people recover. And he agreed in May 1997. We had a great reopening and renamed the facility after Jackie. And then we began expanding our services to include intensive outpatient treatment, an outpatient treatment and alumni group, and then a women's recovery house. And we really believe in a continuum of care where it's really intensive up front, and then the intensity lessens over time.
And Jim, Bill had just mentioned the work that Jackie did to help other people dealing with similar struggles. Can you tell us a little bit about that? How did she devote her life to help other people?
Well, a lot of stories that, you know, it was hard to put together someone's life. They both were passed away, so we had to go out and try to find friends of theirs. But what we did find was people who either she was their sponsor, and they talked about how she was relentless in talking to them any time of the day or any time of the night. And if they didn't have a place to go at Thanksgiving or Christmas, she would open her house to them. She was very, very adamant about getting them into recovery, and she wasn't afraid to have these really hard conversations because dealing with somebody with an addiction, you know, they can really con you a lot of times. So she was really smart. She was small, but she was really tough, and she wasn't afraid to have these hard conversations to get people the help they needed because they could try to trick you. So,
talking to all those people, Jim, tell us a little bit about Jackie and who she was and her personality.
A lot of the people really talked about how she was just a spitfire. You know, she just had a lot of spunk. When she came into the room, you know, everybody knew she was there. She was electric. She was just had this really contagious laugh. She just knew how to network with people, and she knew how to make friends, and she was really warm. Chester Markle said, you know, when you were in a room with her, you could just feel her presence because she was just so vivacious. So I think that's what helped her get committed to staying sober herself was to actually reach out to all these other people and get them on board with where she was going. So I think that was her legacy, was she had that ability, that you know, charisma to do that.
Bill, a lot of people in Jackie's situation then and now, I imagine, deal with it, I assume, on their own, in silence. How does a person either dealing with addiction themselves or with a family member take the first step to talk about the problem and try to get help for it?
The problem with the disease is people try to quit on their own, but they don't understand that it's actually a disease, and it's a medical issue. When there's enough pain, when there's enough consequences, and when the enabling stops, person will then surrender and then reach out and ask for help. But the challenge is they have to give up everything that's familiar to them, even though drinking and using drugs is bad and has negative consequences. They trust they know what's going to happen. But when someone enters recovery, it's a whole new world and there's a lot of changes. And that can be a very scary process for someone to encounter, especially if they do it on their own.
And Bill, we were talking about alcohol in Jackie Nitschke and Ray Nitschke's lives. That was part of the circle they were in. What are some of the other challenges you're dealing with at the center now in the Green Bay area?
Across the country, what we're all struggling with is there's been a major cut in funding for substance abuse treatment. It is the least funded illness of any illness, and a big part of that is because it has the negative stigma attached to it, and nobody understands it, and people think that when somebody relapses that it doesn't work, but it has the same relapse rate as any other physical illness. The challenge is the treatment delivery system is so poorly funded. We're all trying to survive. We just want to help people, but the regulations and the cost to do so keep getting higher and higher.
And Bill,
and then the other.
Bill, as we wrap up in just a few moments, what do you hope people take away from this documentary about Jackie Nitschke?
But we're hoping, my biggest goal is to educate the public, educate families, raise public awareness that the illness affects everybody, that there's a recovery is a great place. It's a great way to live. You can improve the quality of your life. It's okay to talk about the problem, and it's okay to seek help.
Bill, thanks a lot for joining us today.
You're welcome. Thanks for having us.
And Jim, thanks a lot to you as well.
Thank you. Nice to be here.
We've been hearing from Jim Rivett and Bill Labine. They joined us from Green Bay. You can catch a screening of the documentary we've been talking about. It's called Champion, The Legacy of Jackie Nitschke, tonight at 6:30 at the Widener Center in Green Bay.
According to the website DoSomething.org, 91% of women are unhappy with their bodies and diet to try to achieve a more ideal shape.
Recently, a new doll went on sale. It's been called the Normal Barbie. She has the proportions of an average woman, with measurements from the CDC making her shorter and curvier than Mattel's classic Barbie doll.
The Lamely Dolls creator says it's time to look seriously at the impact that dolls like Barbie have on kids' idea of what the ideal body looks like. Nicolay Lamb joins us now. He's a graphic designer and creator of Lamely Dolls, including the so-called Normal Barbie. Nicolay, welcome to Central Time.
Oh, cool. Thank you for having me.
Why do you think the world needs a more realistic representation of what women look like in a doll?
Oh, it's, you know, a lot of people like suggest, you know, I'm kind of like against Barbie, but it's kind of like, you know, when I walk down the toy shelves, I kind of get the impression that it's like we should all look like supermodels, but maybe if there's just another realistic alternative, it's as if the wall would be saying like, yeah, it's cool to be a supermodel, and it's also cool to be just a typical person.
What kind of data did you see out there that women have a tough time being positive about their bodies, and maybe there's a reason to have a more realistic looking doll?
Oh, well, you know, I didn't really use data so much, just, you know, just emails I got and just talking to people. And, you know, there's a whole, you know, I see it in the media all the time about, you know, the skinny models. And I think right now there's like a push for more realism, not only in advertisements, but in toys in general.
You said you traded emails with people, talked to people. What did they say? What did they tell you?
Well, they said like, I remember last year when I released what the media called Normal Barbie, a lot of people were like, you know, hey, where can we get a doll like this? It's a great idea. I want to buy one. And, you know, obviously I can't sell the Barbie branded product, so I created the Lamely doll. And, you know, the whole reason this doll was created was because of those emails.
And what does she look like? Now that you've created this doll, you're a graphic designer. You, it sounds like, went to the CDC to get some measurements. How did you put it together, and what does she look like?
Oh, well, you know, she looks just like a typical person. And I think, like, because she looks so ordinary, like, we tried to make her as, like, typical looking as possible. Like if she was walking down the street, like, you'd be like, oh, hey, Sally. Like, just something very simple. So we used Center for Disease Control measurements as a base. So it's like loosely based on average measurements of the 19-year-old American woman.
So you've got Barbie, who is tall, thin, walks on her tiptoes, has long hair. What's different about your Barbie?
Well, she has feet, so she can wear heels or just typical shoes. And just her overall proportions are just bigger. Her feet are bigger, her hands are bigger, her waist is bigger, and, you know, just everything's kind of more real looking.
There was a piece on your new doll, the so-called Normal Barbie, on the website Jezebel, and the author said there was a couple critiques she made about the Normal Barbie, saying, for one thing, that this is still a doll with long, glossy, beautiful hair and brows that looked like they'd been professionally shaped, and eyes that had looked like, you know, they had mascara, and that she wasn't different enough. What do you say to that?
I mean, you know, I have to start somewhere, and, you know, this is just one doll, and a lot of people are saying, oh, you know, we're all the dolls of different ethnicities, different body types. Oh, you know, this is just one doll, and I have to start somewhere. And yeah, I just have to start somewhere and move forward.
Now, this isn't just a doll that has different proportions than Mattel's version of Barbie. She has a lot of accessories that you see a lot of women actually is having, things like stretch marks. What are some of the other sort of features or add-ons that this doll has?
Oh, well, let me look at the sticker sheet now. So there's an add-on accessory pack called Lamely Marks. So it can have stitches, scars, cellulite, stretch marks, acne, blushing, moles. So it's just kind of like a lot of people are like, oh, this is way over the top. But, you know, the whole point of creating this was trying to make things like cellulite and stretch marks more mainstream, so that if like someone does have it, it's like not a big deal.
Do you think a doll can do all that?
Well, you know, a lot of people like critique me and say like, oh, what's this guy doing? Like thinking a doll can save the world. And, you know, obviously a doll is just a doll. It's just a toy. But I feel it can be a part of helping people just feel better about themselves and who they are. It's obviously not going to fix everything, but I think it's a good start.
Now, you had a very successful, I think it was a Kickstarter campaign to fund this normal Barbie, and it's gone on sale. What's the response so far?
Oh, well, for the original crowdfunding, it raised over $500,000. And, you know, it went on sale on November 19th, and we have around a little over extra $500,000 orders as well. So it's all going pretty well, and the next step is to try to get it into retail.
Now, I assume that when one of the things you did in the development process was test this out on actual kids. Did you do that?
Yeah, we made a video of kids reacting to it, and that was actually the first time when it was being recorded. That was the first time I was seeing kids react to it. So I was very nervous at that point because I knew if kids don't like it, the product has no future. But fortunately, the kids really liked it.
What did they say?
Well, she looks like their sister, her aunt. Like they like the realistic looking toes, like how she just looks. Like because she's so, like to them, to a lot of them, like she was extraordinary because she was so ordinary. Because all the dolls that they have are very like glitzy and stuff, and there's nothing wrong with that, but. Like, because she's so, like, typical looking, they were like, oh, wow, this is, like, really real.
We're talking right now with Nicolay Lam. He's a graphic designer and the creator of the Lamely line of dolls. His so-called normal Barbie recently went on sale. She has average proportions in terms of height and weight and has options like acne and stretch marks.
Now, we want to hear from you. What do you think? Would you buy something like this, a more realistic image as compared to Barbie for your kids, your grandkids, nieces and nephews? Does the normal Barbie address concerns you have about ideal body types for women? Do you have a problem with the Barbie as it exists, or are we overthinking things here? Call in at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. Or you can post on the Central Time Facebook page.
We're talking with Nicolay Lam. He's a graphic designer and the creator of the Lamely line of dolls. His so-called normal Barbie just went on sale. She's got average proportions and height of weight. She's a bit shorter, curvier than Mattel's Barbie. And she's got options like tattoos and stretch marks.
Now we want to hear from you at 800-642-1234. Do you have a problem with the state of the art when it comes to dolls and the message it might send about body image? As a kid, as a parent, have you ever wished there was something different, maybe something more realistic looking out there? Or are we just kind of overreacting to just a toy? Call 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. You can also post at the Central Time Facebook page.
And we'll go to our calls now. We've got Andrea joining us from Madison. Hi, Andrea.
Hi. I'm concerned with our obsession with image in general. I think even labeling something as normal is the saying still that something isn't normal. Like, we're telling girls that the most important thing in their worth comes from their appearance. And that concerns me, whether we're saying, like, oh, it's okay to be mid-sized or large-sized, it's still saying, like, we are more concerned about how you look than who you are.
Okay, well, thank you for your thoughts on that, Andrea. And Nicolea, I know the media has called this the normal Barbie. Do you call her that as well?
No, I mean, clearly not, because if I were to call that, you know, Mattel would be all over me for that. And two, you know, the media, they're all about how the doll looks, because, you know, it's the whole Lamely versus Barbie type thing. That's what they like to talk about. But, you know, the actual doll, she comes with a backstory, and there's nothing in it about, you know, how she looks like or her realistic proportions. It's just like a wholesome doll. So, you know, the whole normal thing, that's also, even though that's not politically correct, it's just an easy way to describe what the doll looks like.
Well, you've got this platform now. You've got the first doll. I understand you're developing other dolls. Will you be exploring a whole range of body sizes and skin colors, backstories, all of that?
Yeah, of course, because, you know, it's going to be, that's like what I have to do, and that was my vision from the very beginning. I just have to start from one doll and branch out.
We had a comment here on Facebook. Kyle writes, I wouldn't buy this for my daughter, but if she received it as a gift, I would encourage her to play with it and would especially over Barbie. She's only three, so he's putting off playing with dolls until she's older. So one vote there from Kyle. And we're going to hear now from another caller and take Gigi in Madison. Hi there. Gigi, are you on the air? Are you there?
Yes.
Hi, what do you think? Would you play with a doll that looked different than Barbie, that was shorter, curvier, didn't look the way that you might expect a doll like that to look?
I think that I would play with a Barbie doll that would look more realistic, and it would set an example for girls and other children that you don't need to look starved to be beautiful. And, like, you don't need to have blue eyes and blonde hair to be beautiful. You can have anything. It doesn't even matter if you have freckles or not.
So you're someone who's in the Barbie playing age. You're interested in dolls. Is this something you hear from your friends that they worry maybe about how they look? Maybe they worry about their weight. Is this something that already is something kids are talking about?
Well, I have experienced one child that I know that has been made fun of about her weight, and she has been just trying to get the children to stop. And
gotcha.
Yeah.
All right. Well, thank you so much for calling and giving us a perspective from someone who would be playing with one of these dolls. Nicolay, she's described someone she knew who had trouble with body teasing, people teasing her about body shape. Is this something you think could be improved if there were access to more dolls like this?
Yeah, of course. Like, my opinion is if they're dolls which have different body types, it's kind of suggesting, like, yeah, it's okay to be this body shape, it's okay to be that body shape, it's all good. It's just who you are, and there's nothing wrong with that.
Well, Gigi, thank you so much for that call. We've got an open line for you at 800-642-1234. That's 800-642-1234. If you have a child, a grandchild, a niece, or a nephew in your life, how do you think that they would react to finding a doll like this under the tree? Maybe instead of something more mainstream in terms of doll brands, would this be something that your kids would enjoy or you as a parent would want to seek out for your child? 800-642-1234. And in terms of the backstory, Nicolay, you said that this doll comes with a backstory. And one of the critiques of the doll is that, again, from the same Jezebel writer, that the doll is still just something you dress up, that it doesn't empower girls enough. Is there more in the backstory, more to it, that gives her more empowerment possibilities?
Yeah, well, for number one, she's the backstory of the doll. She's like a world traveler, and she just likes to do cool things. And also that Jezebel writer, I don't think she looked at my own website, to be honest. Because on the website, the doll is doing push-ups, doing running. And, you know, if that's not action for her, I don't know what is. Like, I feel she overlooked a lot of things.
What is your hope for how girls who look outside, you know, the Barbie ideal will take this doll, will be affected by it?
You know, I feel it's not so much about what the doll looks like. I feel like by making a doll look so typical looking, it's kind of like the attention is taken away from what the doll looks like and more so on what she does. Because with other dolls, it's kind of like I can't help but looking like, okay, this is a little off, that's a little off in terms of her body. But if like a doll just looks typical and like ordinary looking, then it's as if like I feel it can help children focus more on what the doll is doing and not on what she looks like.
And we've got a caller or someone who had called and couldn't stay on the line, Jerry, asking, where can I buy this doll? I want to purchase one for my 8-year-old daughter and hope that it's a good influence on her.
Oh, yeah. Right now it's only available online at lamily.com, LAMMILY.
Great. And going forward, you said you've got some new dolls on the horizon. Is there any other boundary stretching that you'd like to do, that you'd like to smash through when you're looking at this kind of doll?
Oh, well, I have a lot of ideas, but for example, a boy doll, dolls of different body types. And I have some really cool backstory ideas, and I know it'll definitely push some boundaries, and it's not like what you typically see in dolls, but I think a lot of people will like it.
And what about boys? Would boys play with his dolls? Would it maybe be good for boys to see that not all bodies are the same?
Yeah, I think so. But, you know, a lot of people were telling me like, oh, you know, come out with a boy doll. It's going to sell great. But, you know, I feel to make a boy doll successful, it has to have like a really cool backstory. And, you know, that's the main thing I'm going to work on for the boy doll, you know, aside from obviously making it with typical proportions too.
Okay, Nicolay, thank you for joining us.
Thank you for having me.
That was Nicolay Lamb, graphic artist, creator of the Lamily line of dolls, which includes the so-called normal Barbie.